Hello and welcome to Morning Energy Live. I'm your host, Andrew Gillick, and with me today, I am honored to have Meg Mollenstein, CEO of GeoSouthern. Meg is a titan of the shale revolution with a legendary knack for finding values where others only see dirt. She's been two steps ahead of the market for over three decades, leading GeoSouthern through some of the most significant deals in the history of American oil and gas. She architected the historic $6 billion exit to Devon Energy in the Eagle Ford, the $1.85 billion sale to Southwestern, and she's fresh off a massive GEP Haynesville 2 exit just weeks ago. But the Meg origin story is even better than all that, and which I'll let her share with you today. I'm truly humbled to have her time. Meg, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning to you, Andrew, and everyone out there.
All right, before we get started, I got five questions for you so the listeners can get to know you a little better. Cool? You ready?
Okay.
It's not a quiz show,
Don't
don't
make
worry.
it.
These are
Don't be
easy
a
ones.
college quiz bowl here, Andrew,
No,
okay?
no. It's not a quiz bowl. All right, so Meg, what was the first concert you ever went to?
Styx, Shreveport, Louisiana. I wasn't even old enough to drive.
I bet that was fun.
It was great.
I can sort of imagine, I can imagine the scene. Sounds like a great time. All right, next. Meg, beach or mountains, what do you prefer? Now, remind you, it's a year-round commitment.
Beach. I don't
Hands
like
down.
cold weather. Pardon?
No cold weather.
No cold weather.
Visit the
I don't
mountains
like it.
in the summer, and that's it.
Well, in the summer, if you call them mountains in Hot Springs, Arkansas, we do like those because
Okay.
they're really hills.
All right. Have you been to more states or more countries?
More states.
All right, I like it. Now, this is a new one for those of you who've been listening in the past. Meg, what's the most interesting object in your office?
Well, it's a stuffed rattlesnake, of course. And I have
Of
him here
course.
with me. He's right here.
Oh, well, maybe you could tell us the story about this rattlesnake.
Well, my executive team for years has heard me use a saying that says that my grandfather taught me, and it says, "You can deal with snakes. You just got to know which end to pick them up by." So finally, Richard and the team had heard that enough and presented me with the stuffed rattlesnake for my birthday. It's one of the best gifts I've ever gotten.
I mean, that is sage advice. I don't think I can top that. I love it. We're gonna have to talk about your other friend on the other side later, but we'll get back to that. What
Thank you.
okay, last question. What's the best sandwich?
It would be the chicken salad sandwich from Jason's Deli.
Oh, all right. I do like a good chicken salad. Lettuce, tomato, or just like rye bread. How do you do it?
It
Croissant.
comes on a croissant, and it's a special chicken salad recipe that is from Jason's Deli.
I love it. All right. That was great, Meg. Thank you very much. I feel like the audience now really has a good sense for you. All right, now but maybe before we jump into, all the stuff people want to hear about, you can tell the audience a little bit about how you got here. And I don't mean how you got to the computer this morning, but the successful CEO of multiple private companies.
Well,
Where did it all start?
I grew up in southern Arkansas, Magnolia, Arkansas, born and raised there. And my grandfather and my father were both in the oil business. My grandfather was a wildcatter, and he was one of the first guys in down there in the 1920s and helped find and bring in some of those fields, like in the Stevens Field, and he was around in the Smackover and some of the others down in North Louisiana. And then my dad was a geologist, a landman, and an oil and gas lease broker. And I grew up in the business. Some of my earliest and fondest memories were riding in the car with my grandfather and my dad while they negotiated and closed deals throughout South Arkansas, North Louisiana, East Texas. And I learned a lot from them just riding in the car as a little girl and had a love for the business. I quickly learned from my grandfather when you brought ice cream to a deal to close it, and when you brought whiskey to a deal to close it. And I've used that learning for many years in my life. And so by the time I was 12, I was helping my dad. I was typing oil and gas leases, pulling books in the courthouses, you know, around all the crews. And it's really all I ever wanted to do. And after I finished law school, instead of practicing law, I went back to work with my dad, who at the time was putting water floods together for the Sun Oil Company. And I did that for a while and eventually made my way to Dallas with the help of a lot of friends and a lot of people. And went through several companies, Weber Energy and Union Pacific being the last two. And at the time, we were in the heyday of the Giddings Field. We were drilling some of the first horizontal wells that were ever drilled in that part of the country. And we were in the infancy of the horizontal drilling boom down there. And it taught us a lot. I met my good friend, Richard Borsmeyer, who's my COO during that time at Union Pacific. Met George Lindahl, who was running the company at the time. And most importantly, I met George Bishop, because he had already been in the Giddings Field and had drilled hundreds of vertical chalk wells, and we needed acreage to farm in. So I was the one that was sent to go talk to George. We became instant business friends and did trade after trade after trade together, and the rest is history. So Anadarko bought UP in 2000. We made our way down here to the Woodlands. And by 2006, I was getting some offers from some other companies and getting a little bit restless with a big corporation. And I went to George Bishop to ask his advice. And it was the luckiest thing I ever did. George's advice to me was, I was wondering when you were going to come and ask me this. And are you ready to come over to GeoSouthern? Which I did. And that was in June of 2006, and the rest is history. So I never practiced law, and thank God I didn't, because I would have been a terrible lawyer.
So you didn't like the big corporate atmosphere? I couldn't really see you, you know, having to follow all the rules like that, Meg.
Andrew, I had a hard time following rules. And thank God I had some pretty good bosses at Union Pacific, Mr. Lindahl and Andy Rutterow. They kind of understood me. And in fact, Andy said, just give her a credit card and let her go. Just do it. Just give her a credit card and let her go and let her come back with the paper.
That's amazing. Seems like the mindset has served you well in your career.
Of help from a lot of people and a lot of good friends. And a great team here.
Of course, yeah. Speaking of teams, so why don't you tell us about this most recent exit? I think it was to JERA, right? A Japanese utility, rather than another North American operator. You know, and we've seen a couple of deals like this, and a lot more interest with these utilities coming around. And I know we've seen this story before early in shale with different buyers, but today. Do you see the international utilities moving upstream as a permanent structural shift?
I do. I see more to come. And first, let me clarify. We have not closed with JERA yet.
We fully expect to do so.
We've received all of our government approvals. I see nothing that would stop it. But my dad taught me something else. Margaret Ella, do not spend that money till it hits your bank account. Okay? So until
more stage of place.
Until we're officially closed, I do want to point that out. But I see every reason that we will. And yes, I think that the internationals are going to be here for all the reasons that JERA came to us. Energy security, a natural hedge against Henry Hub pricing, the need to integrate the supply chain. And just, you know, in our case, think about JERA. They have a billion cubic feet a day of LNG offtake capacity on the Gulf Coast. They need the molecules, and we fit the bill perfectly. We give them a reliable and repeatable source of the gas that they need for their offtake. And we have the locations there. We had over 200 locations that we're selling to them in inventory, and the ability to make 1 billion cubic feet a day once the Dorn project is put in place by Williams. You know, we will be able to do that for them. And also, we have existing gathering and transportation in the proximity of the Gulf Coast. So I think for all of those reasons, we're going to see more of this to come. And I think they're going to be branching out into other areas that are going to be accessible to this LNG system that we've built on the Gulf Coast. I think we're going to see some of it in the Eagle Ford, maybe in the MidCon. And I think it's here. It's here to stay.
So the utilities that are coming in to secure their supply downstream now, which, you know, a little further back than they usually do, maybe, are going to get past the Haynesville to, like you said, MidCon, maybe Eagle Ford. Now, do you think that? So is it that their way of just the hedge, so they can lock in the price and they don't have to worry about the volatility in the Gulf Coast?
I think that's one of the reasons, Andrew, but I think there's other reasons. I think we offer them, you know, we're safe geopolitically, and we do have that infrastructure in place to get it down there. You know, you've got the gathering and transportation. And I think it, in addition to the hedge, it's the energy security. And then, you know, having those molecules there for the offtake.
No, that makes sense. The Gulf Coast has once again become an incredibly valuable resource for the country. So most, I would say, argue that your track record of exits in particular is excellent. first in the Eagle Ford in 24 before Black Friday, and now in the Haynesville a second time, potentially. Ahead of what seems to be some real solid price volatility. So Meg, what's your secret? Or rather, what are the specific metrics or signals that you look for that tell you it's time to sell or it's time to drill?
I wish I was as smart as you're making me out to be, but here's the way we always look at these deals. We go into these deals to make money and to operate them for the life of the well. You know, we'd never go into these deals with the idea that we have a specific time to leave or an exit strategy, or, you know, that it's not going to be ours for the life of the well. You know, it's sort of like babies. Some are early, some are late, and some never get here. So, you know, you have to look at it like you're here forever. Now, my secret, if somebody comes up, like in the case of Jarrett, with $1.5 billion check and the money looks good enough, then yes, we look at that. We look to see and balance, you know, how long would it take us to make that amount of money? And, you know, if everything goes right and if we're right about what our price decks are saying. And, you know, that's the way we look at it. If we think we could, this is a better deal than if we'd sat here and operated it for another 10 years, we go on and make money. Luckily, so far, we've guessed on the right side. I guess I wouldn't be so happy if we had a snowmageddon that lasts for 2 years and I could have made even more money. But
right.
At some point, you're satisfied and it makes sense.
For sure. Yeah, it makes me think, you know, the sort of, as we get to this part of the life cycle in shale, and with less and less out there to do, and all the consolidation that we've seen, you know, one of the questions I wanted to ask you is, can the private operator still compete in today's shale world? I think the other question or a corollary is, do you think the other private operators are going to go back to approaching the business the way you just described versus to buy and flip, which we saw a lot of over the last, you know, 15 years?
I believe that was part of the reason that the private equity people, a lot of them left the space, because they had time horizons and needed to get in or out. You can't time a well. You gotta go with the flow. You know, you've got the risk analysis.
Okay.
And your question about privates, do I think that they're here and are going to stay? And are we still going to be here? The answer is yes. It's a David and Goliath story. Okay. We've been doing this for 110 years or more. Well, I guess my grandfather since the 20s, you know, however long that was.
Yeah.
And I think we're here for all the reasons that all these guys have done it in the past. You know, we've got more risk tolerance, and we can go on a smaller scale, and we can go places that don't move the needle for the big publics. Now, true, we don't have access to cheapest money, and we don't have the access to the money that the capital that the big publics have. But at the same time, you know, sometimes we can go, you know, try to catch a little fish, and that fish grows into something big.
So, okay. So yes. The answer is yes. I see that. And there's always going to be something to do on the smaller side. Do you think there's anything left to do in North America that isn't already under intense scrutiny? Is there a secret basin you'd like to reveal today on Morning Energy Live?
I wouldn't tell you. We're looking at a lot of things, and we're buying some leases in some different places. But yes, I think there's always things to do. I think we go back to your other question about, you know, the difference between the way privates work and publics. You know, we've got speed, risk tolerance. We're going into areas that, you know, are smaller scale areas, that are step out areas, trying to use some technology and some old fashioned wildcatting. You know, going back to the seismic lines and looking around and looking at old logs and, you know, just really going back to trying to wildcat again and get into some of these new areas. You know, going into step out areas that were maybe a little too hot or maybe a little too deep to go that we wouldn't have gone before. And we're having some success at that. So, yeah, I think there's a lot to do. And I also think that you may see, it won't be us, but you may see some of these guys going international again.
You think some of the private operators will step out internationally?
I think you might see some private guys go international again.
Like for shale or for more conventional, like let's not talk about Venezuela, but outside of that, like, or maybe we can, but do you think it'll be like a shale move internationally or offshore? Or where do you think
people? I think it could be both. I think it could be all of the above. You know, as things get tighter and tighter, you know, you have to be creative. You know, it's the David and Goliath story.
Sure.
And David defeated Goliath because of ingenuity and risk taking.
For sure. And that's something that the oil and gas industry has been full of its entire being, the creativity, your point, the risk taking, but the technology and the ability to innovate.
Yes.
You've been telling me about that as we've been preparing for this, the changing technology and what it's allowed you to do.
Yes.
You know, just over the last 15, 20 years or so. Is that why you think there's still stuff to do left in North America versus where we were like 15 years ago in technology?
I do. I believe that. I mean, again, go back to the example of the horizontal wells we were drilling were 2,500 feet. We're drilling 16,000 feet now in deeper and hotter conditions. And we're drilling now with one rig what it was taking us two rigs to do. And, you know, Lord knows what else is on the horizon. Completion designs, you know, new and better ways to look at 2D and 3D seismic. You know, we were amazed when we mapped the Giddings Field with 3D, and we saw the Better Car Fault just completely mapped out. It completely explained why back in the day with Mr. Lindahl at UP, we would drill one well that was a great well, and right beside it, we would drill one that was no good. Well, now we know. And I think it's going to be more and more and more of that on the horizon. And as we get creative and get in here and do some more exploration.
That's exciting. You know, it's the resource is there, the demand is there, and now it's just a matter of unlocking. I'm personally excited to see how recoveries can improve, right? Like what's the average shale well recovery, 9% or something like that? Well, how do we get it to 15? I mean, that's a lot, right? Especially right. Whether it's a new drill or just wells that have already been drilled, right?
Enhanced that's recovery. Right. That's right. Now, there's so many things, though, that are beyond our control. You know, we're in the oil business. We're in a very, very risky business. We got weather. We got the economy, geopolitics. But then, you know, there's things that we can control as well.
Yeah, now that makes sense. So as we were talking about, Jaron, we're talking about LNG. Clearly, it's what's driving the gas markets here in North America. It sounds like it's why you made the choices that you have recently in what to pursue. You know, the data center power demand to me is a little bit of a headline sideshow from a demand perspective, just on the sheer volume of demand so far. And that could change depending on how things get built out. But one of the questions that, you know, a lot of us are thinking about is, does the world need or want all the gas that we're preparing to give it as the Gulf Coast liquefaction complex continues to grow? Or are we gonna overdo it again?
Well, my answer is maybe. And my answer is I hope that they're gonna need all of this gas. I mean, you know, it is a fact. There's 5 new LNG facilities that are coming on the Gulf Coast. I do believe that there's going to be some need with the AI revolution coming. Is it all that they've hyped and said? No, I read there's 375 new projects that have been approved. Now, will all of that get done? No, not all of it will get done, but it will be some. And I think we're going to continue to see coal to natural gas conversion on plants. But again, there's things beyond our control that are going to affect the price, like weather and economy and geopolitics. It's our business, and we've all learned that it's up and down, and that's just kind of the way it is. You know, we had all the talk in the 90s about the data centers coming on and all of that. A little of it happened and a little of it didn't happen, and I think that's what's going to happen with this AI revolution.
And maybe it's the timing too, right? They built in the 90s, they built all that fiber out, right? And then all those fiber companies went bankrupt. But all that fiber is being used now. It just wasn't used to the extent that they were using it back in, or they thought they would use it back in 1999. So that totally makes sense. And so
I think also there's going to be new types of energy that are going to be coming into the market as well.
Okay.
Like geothermal.
Okay.
And maybe some more nuclear and some other things like that might affect us.
And in terms of a little bit of a headwind for power demand in the United States.
Yes.
Yeah. Or globally, I guess, if geothermal is going to be not just a U.S. thing, it's going to be global, like a nuclear renaissance happens. Yeah, that could. But at the moment, I don't think we're there yet, right? And it's going to take time to get those nuclear plants built and figure out the geothermal recipe, I guess. So I guess we still got a little time to sell natural gas.
Yes, we do. I think we're going to need some fossil fuels, hopefully for the next 100 years or forever.
Well, I'm not sure we have forever, but you know, we'll see how it all rolls out. But
yeah.
But as we think about technology, right? And you've built teams, you know, lots of teams over your career. One of the things that I'm told is we have sort of a generational gap in the oil field in terms of expertise, right? As you know, we seem to just as the business is cyclical. And so meaning we're sort of short the 15 to 25 year experienced folks. So I guess the question I have for you is someone, you know, in the industry here like this, are you seeing enough young talent entering the petroleum engineering and geology side to support the growth that we need, or are we going to have a problem, you think?
We're cyclical. We've talked about that several times this morning. As prices go down and layoffs happen and all of that, you'll see these gaps in talent. And but it always seems to come back. And I think good people are the basis of a good private company. And thank God I have a wonderful team, and they deserve all the credit here for what they've helped us do. I think the volatility is the catalyst for, you know, these swings in the personnel. I think we could do better in our universities and our technical schools on training up some more people. And, we're seeing some evidence of that. I'm on the board at Southern Methodist University, their energy program, their advisory board, and we're seeing a shift of a lot of kids that are coming in there that are wanting to get into all those different sides of energy. And I think that could be an emphasis. I think if we want to find some good talent, we've always been able to find it. Back to your part of the question about, is AI going to take the place of some of these kids? Maybe some, but I think that there's never a substitute for judgment, for a young geologist getting in there and going back to the basics of learning how to explore again. And I think that's some of the things we're missing. And, I don't think there's any computer that could take the place of that geologist that goes in and studies the mapping and studies the 3D and comes up with his interpretation. I don't think there's any substitute for the engineer who thinks out of the box and can come up with new ways to complete a well or innovative ways to improve our drilling technology. I sure don't think there's any way that a computer can go down and talk to a rancher in South Texas and secure an oil and gas lease from that guy. I don't think there's any way that a computer would do that. Now,
I mean, don't talk to Elon Musk about that. He might build a robot for you to go down and start negotiating
some of these guys I've dealt with in South Texas, that robot would be shot before it ever crossed the gate, you know.
Absolutely.
He wouldn't know what was coming, you know. But do I think AI can fill some of the gap? I do. In some of the more mundane type things, like gathering the information, reading oil and gas leases and compiling information and getting the data together for our petrotechnical staff to analyze and investigate. I also think, just don't look exclusively at oil and gas, energy, back to my comment about geothermal or nuclear, or other parts of our energy picture and focus that could fill the gap if we're not having enough positions in oil and gas proper.
Oh, that makes sense. The idea of having the experience to leverage the AI to speed all of the work that you're doing is think what we're seeing also in the world today. That makes a lot of sense.
I will add this. I don't think that there's any substitute for having gray hair to be able to talk to these younger guys coming in. Because I know in my career, I would never have learned what I've learned had I not had some old guy that I could go in and talk to about some technical issues or a contract or a deal. I never would have been able to do that. And I think that, you know, all of these kids that think that they can learn all this off of a computer or working from home, I don't think it can happen.
You're preaching to the choir, Meg. I don't use Just for Men just yet, right? The grays are coming in, but I think having had those folks in my career as well to help me, you know, learn and understand something that I can't find on, like you said, on a computer is definitely invaluable. All right, this friend of yours has been staring at me the whole time here over your shoulder there. Could you tell me a little bit about why that's the second most interesting thing in your office?
It's in my office. And again, my friend Richard is Richard Borsmeyer, our COO, is responsible for my acquisition of this stuffed raccoon holding a beer can. We were
Okay.
in South Texas, and I noticed one of these down in a bar and admired it greatly, especially after a few beers. And I really, really wanted one. And lo and behold, Richard found me one and presented it for my birthday one year. And his name is Richard.
Oh, well, that was very nice of you to name it after your name it after your friend. I'm sure you have like good brainstorming sessions with Richard. Either
Yes,
one.
we
I guess
do.
both Richards
Richard,
probably. Yeah.
yes, Richard and I have been together since the early 90s at UP days, and yeah,
That's
he's my
great.
right hand. I don't know what we'd do around here without Richard.
That's fantastic. Well, this has been an awesome conversation. What do you have one question for me?
I want to know what you think about AI. What do you
Oh.
think it's, what effect do you think it's going to have on the number of people that we need in the business, and pros and cons?
So I don't think we're going to need as many people in the business as we have in the past. I think that AI is going to allow for faster processing of 3D, faster processing of data. I think that you're going to be able to come to conclusions more quickly. But you do still need the folks that have the experience at the moment to prompt the AI, to ask it the questions, to get it to the answer that you're looking for. It's not just an easy button that somebody can press and get all the answers they want. There's still a lot of work to do across the an oil and gas company, a power company, any kind of energy company, right? You need, I think that you need that experience, right? But there are pitfalls, right? Because if you don't build enough of that experience with the younger folks, how do you ever get the gray hairs in the organizations? And I think that's what a lot of companies are dealing with right now, trying to balance that. How do we continue to perform and create value for our stakeholders while making sure to leave a legacy or leave enough for folks to follow in the footsteps. So I think there could become an over-reliance on it, which could be dangerous. I watch in the schools right now, as most people know, I have two daughters who are in middle school and high school, and I was very concerned about how the school is going to approach using it, right? It's a learning tool potentially, and I think on the one hand we have to embrace it, but on the other hand, it's not the only answer. You need all that other education to go along with it. So I see it as a great accelerator in a lot of ways, but buyer beware, I guess, is the cautionary tale at the moment. So we'll see. All right. Well, Meg, any final words of wisdom here that you'd like to share with the audience before we go?
I don't think so. I've appreciated being invited on this morning, and wish everybody well.
Well, this has been great. It's been my absolute pleasure to get to visit with you here, and look forward to seeing you again soon. All right,
Yes,
thanks everyone for tuning in. It's been great.
thank you, Andrew. Don't do anything I wouldn't do.
Ooh.